Blog Talk Radio.
Mojuba Akoda, Mojuba Asheda, Mojuba Aluami, Apolabi Pega, Mojuba Arabami, Adesanya Awuyade, Mojuba Ogute Compound Ode Remo, Mojuba Baba, Mojuba Yeye, Mojuba Egun to all the God children, Mojuba Egun to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba Egungun to all the chiefs, Mojuba Egungun to all the Awos, Mojuba Egungun to all those that are listening, who are tuned in. We give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe-o.
Ashe-o.
Ashe-o. Welcome to Sign of the Times, everybody. This is Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by the United African Coalition for Justice and Human Rights, the People's Platform for Equality and Justice, and of course, New Power Radio Network. We began Sign of the Times after the unjust Zimmerman verdict of 2013, and we invite you to support us and our sponsors, Manhood Raising Culture, headed up by Dr. James Jones. You can find Dr. Jones on Facebook as James Jones, as well as a like and group page for Manhood Raising Culture, and on the World Wide Web at manhoodraceculture.com. We also want to always remember to never forget our brothers and sisters who are behind enemy lines. So support the Free Alabama Movement, the Free Ohio Movement, and the National Freedom and Justice Movement. In unity we stand, and we're strongest together. So please reach out to the National Freedom and Justice Movement and get involved, especially if you have a loved one who is behind enemy lines. So tonight we're going to have a listen and learn session. And there's a reason why we are having so many listen and learn sessions, and it's because we need to listen and we need to learn. We need to remember who we are, not only as individuals, but as a group of people. And the things that we have been unfortunately subjected to are the reasons why our condition is in the condition that it's in. We can't ever internalize, I guess, a lot of the things that have happened to us. A lot of the things that have happened to us have resulted in us being victimized. So we need to be aware of that. And meritorious manumission is just one of those things. So tonight we're going to hear from Dr. Claude Anderson, Dr. Amos Wilson, the last poet, and we're going to mix it up a little bit with a few other things like Malcolm and some of the things that he talked about as well that have targeted us as a group of people. So we're going to start off with Black Sellouts and their Meritorious Manumission. If you'd like to reach me, you can do so on Facebook as Queen Tahira here in Sign of the Times and New Power Radio Network, as well as on the World Wide Web at FreeOhioMovement.org. Thank you, everybody. We love you. Thank you. And most of all, we respect you. We'll be back. All right, here we go.
Put into slavery, we were beat into submission, and the person that we looked up to was the slave master. So what you have to understand, a lot of black people in America look at themselves through the eyes of the slave master. We feel the same way that they feel about us. We want the same thing.
There have always been laws that would pit African-American people against other African-American people. During slavery, they had a law called the Meritorious Manumission Law, where African people would get rewarded for turning in another African slave or turning in a person who wanted to create some type of rebellion or runaway slave. So there were all types of incentives to give African American people for turning on each other.
We know that the first full-time FBI agent in American history, black agent, was actually hired to infiltrate the Marcus Garvey movement, working under the supervision of J. Edgar Hoover to destabilize it.
African American people are the only people who are rewarded for turning on other African American people. You don't see that with other people in the dominant society. You don't see Latino people being rewarded for turning on other Latino people. You don't see Asian people being rewarded for turning on other Asian people. But if there are African American people who are willing to talk badly or negatively about other African American people or throw other African American people under the bus, they get book deals, they get TV shows, they get radio show deals. So there are all types of rewards and incentives for African Americans to throw other African Americans under the bus. And this comes directly from slavery.
You know, at one time, the black man had to grin and smile all the time. Everything, it didn't matter what. You had to keep grinning, keep smiling. That was to show all of the white people that you were not hostile and you was a happy Negro. You wasn't mad about nothing. No matter how I've been treated, I'm still happy.
In the history of America, there have always been compromising black people who would do things to compromise the rest of the community. And there have been several names historically for black people who do things like this. The sellout, Uncle Tom, Mammy, Coon. I mean, all types of names utilized for people who will compromise the rest of the black community.
You can't be born a coon. No, you have to practice being a coon. Practice grinning, practice bucking your eyes. Yeah, it's hard work to be a coon.
Mm-hmm. Well, that man is just wasting money.
From coon to tycoon.
The United States Army Office of Intelligence hired a black man by the name of R.R. Moody. This is going to blow people's mind. Booker T. Washington, vice principal at Tuskegee Institute, was a paid undercover intelligence officer for the United States Army, whose job was to spy on Booker T because they were concerned that he was using Tuskegee, and they were correct in their suspicions, as a hideout for black revolutionaries away from the Klan and away from the government. We know that the man who infiltrated Malcolm and served as one of his security men, Gene Roberts, was an agent. And then after he brought Malcolm down, he goes and brings the Panthers down. So they used him again after, because nobody knew who he was yet. So they was able to use him again, and then he brought down the Panthers.
There is one thing that we have to be dealing with, and that is the issue of a total emancipation and liberation of our people. And if that's not the deal, then you're not part of the solution. And so we have to look at this very carefully, and we have to let folk know, whatever they may be, with all those minorities, if we all came together, we would understand we are the majority. But as long as we are divided, we will be conquered. And as long as they can play one group against another group, whatever it may be, whether it is the internal Willie Lynch syndrome or whether it is a cultural Willie Lynch syndrome, we will always be controlled, contained, and dominated by the true minority.
It was set up in the Virginia colony and then also later into South Carolina. It's called meritorious manumission. Meritorious means to earn. Manumission means to release. So a black could earn his release from slavery if he did one of four things, or a combination, elaboration, or sophistication of those four things. One, if he could prove to whites that he could see things through the eyes of a white person. And he'd prove it by, one, saving a white person's life. Two, saving a white person's property. Three, inventing something or improving the profits that he gets from picking cotton and corn or tobacco. Or four, if he would squeal on and tell on any other black person who was trying to escape from slavery. That was called meritorious manumission. We still got blacks in America that's working hard and diligently to get meritorious manumission. They're working hard to make sure that they protect a white person's property. I don't care, and they protect it by any time you come out with an affirmative action program. I have the dubious honor of being the person who wrote that first affirmative action plan for the state of Florida in 1971 that went all over the country, a comprehensive plan. I didn't write the plan for minorities, poor folk, Asians, Hispanics, Arabs, midgets, humpbacks, lesbians. I wrote it for black folk. But immediately the whole frame of reference is the way you keep black folk down is always to loot and water something and make pretend it's for everybody. And that way anything for everybody is for nobody. And so they took that minority program, the affirmative action program, made it a minority program. And see, now I want the affirmative action program to die for that reason. In 1999, I go down to Texas, and a program is written for black folk. I look at the amount of money in state contracts in Texas that year. And white women got 78%. And nobody in our black leadership, in our black overclass, in the black civil rights movement ever said, hold a second, how are you going to put white women into an affirmative action program set up for black folk when she was right along with the white man? She co-owned, co-controlled, co-influenced, co-inherited, and everything that the white slave owner had, she had it too. She sat in the same house, under the same table, slept in the same bed, and raised his kids. How is she entitled to be competitive with black men or black people in the society? But our black leadership didn't say anything, so white women went into the affirmative action program and took it over and dominated it. That's why you go to check Coca-Cola about 3 years ago. Coca-Cola Company, almost 66% of all the money on the minority program went to white women. And in Texas, white women got 78%. And Hispanics got 21%, and blacks got 0.9%. Because again, we don't know how to play the game. We keep buying into these myths about people, about these very broad, ambiguous groupings. And all of that stuff started immediately after the Civil War.
Racism is a team sport.
Mm-hmm.
Either you play as a team or you lose by default.
Right.
We have no social cohesiveness in our race. We have no social cohesiveness. We keep trying to play by as individuals, because whites teach you and engineer you into believing that somehow that individualism is important. Individualism is not important in a race-based society. And if white folks didn't enslave black folks individually, enslave them as a group.
You said that leadership, unlike it was before,
have given, we've given our leadership to politicians and different folks who don't even know what they, don't even care about us. And somewhere in one of your questions, you talk about leadership. What we've done. I'm trying to remember which one it was.
Yeah, well, that's the origination of leadership. See, the first time we ever had any significant black leaders was after they had an evangelical movement that moved through this country in about the late 1700s.
Right.
And where they when the religious movement came across America, all of us black folk expressed an interest in going to church, and they would take whites, let black folk go to church with them, but, you know, ride in the carriage or stay outside. And finally, so I said, we'll let you sit up in the balcony as long as you're separated from whites and listen to a religious ceremony, because we're going to use the scriptures from the Bible to enslave your Oriens in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And so by 1818, they finally came out with a thing that said it's okay for blacks to have religious indoctrination.
Yeah.
And they gave out a catechism which says these are the things that black persons must play as to do. He has to be hardworking, and again, follow those things of 1710. Work hard, respect white folk, and then look for pie in the sky. And so they say, but the only thing about it, we must choose new black leadership. We're going to let black ministers be the leaders, starting in 1818.
Mm-hmm.
And black ministers became the first leaders in America. They stayed pretty effective in that until up to about after the Civil War. And at that point in time, they began to move a little. They quasi-freed black folk. When they quasi-freed black and allowed some of them to vote, then we got new leadership that came in about 1870.
Mm-hmm.
And these blacks now, so the leadership moved from a minister, it moves to black leaders being elected to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
But as those blacks got elected to public office in the 1870s, they were put on a code of ethics that says, again, if you come to a position in the public sector, in a public job, whether you're elected or appointed, you cannot do certain things. Again, you cannot come to a public office and express any concern about black folk. Two, that you cannot be able to come in there and talk about groupism. Or three, you cannot, again, try to hold white people accountable for the enslavement of your people for 360 years.
Mm-hmm.
That became a code of ethics for black folks starting in 1870s. It is still in existence where black folk are seeking meritorious Marion Mitchell. That's why all these blacks sitting in public office right now will never, never do anything for black folk. There is no direct connection between putting a black person in a public office and black folks specifically getting benefits. How can a black person sit in a public office and do things specifically for Jews, for Arabs, for Asians, for Hispanics, for women, for midgets, for humpbacks, for transgenders, for people with hernias or hemorrhoids? They won't do anything for black folk. Did a survey back in 1960,
mm-hmm.
where I looked at on black elected officials,
mm-hmm.
compared to the social economic discomfort conditions of black folk across America in terms of food stamps, welfare, imprisonment, dysfunctional schools, dysfunctional family, drug abuse, all these kind of things. I use the social indicators to equate the conditions of black folk, because at that time in 1960 you only had three black elected official of any significance in the
mm-hmm.
country.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, I did that survey and showed that black folk were going into extremely bad conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I waited 30 years from 1960 to 1990, and I used the same indicators to see
mm-hmm.
what are the conditions of black folk in 1990. It should be tremendously better, because the number of black elected officials have gone up over 9,000. 9,000. They're going from 3 to over 9,000. That's a 9,000% increase.
Mm-hmm.
I said if there's a 9,000% increase, then hell, that should be, black folks should be floating on air.
Mm-hmm.
I said, let me see what the conditions are. I looked at the conditions and ran the same indicators, and not only had black folk not progressed, they've gone backwards. They've gone backwards because they've still being injured by that code of ethics that was put in place in 1870.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that black folk in public office must not do anything for their own people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why there's never been a connection between putting a black person in office and black folk getting benefits, except a few instances that I talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But the Harold Washingtons, the Maynard Jacksons, Adam Clayton Powell, the Joanne Watsons, and the Dorothy Tillmans.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few couple of more, but that's it. That's
mm-hmm.
it. Most blacks go to public office. The first statement they're going to make is, I'm here to represent all the people. And that's a violation. That is a contradiction of the principle of politics. Politics is based on a very simple premise, Dorothy.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on the concept of quid pro quo,
mm-hmm.
something for something. One hand washes the other. If I elect you to public office, you must represent me in a representative nation. This government is functioning on being representative of a certain constituents.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get elected to a public office, your first responsibility that you swear an oath to, saying, I hereby promise and swear to protect and serve those who put me in office.
Right.
And black elected officials never, never, never accept that, even though they swear on the Bible, that's what they're going to do.
The establishment, though it may reward us, in order to maintain its control, if necessary, it will kill us. The essential idea that motivates white supremacy is that of maintaining control and dominance. And this establishment that maintains control and dominance will at one time reward you, Negro bourgeoisie. And when necessary to maintain its control, will also kill you. And I'm saying that because there are some of us who think because we are receiving certain rewards from this system that these rewards will continue forever. But you have to recognize rewards are a mean of control as much as punishment. We talk about it in psychology as what? Positive reinforcement. Yeah. Bribing. Yeah. So you give positive reinforcement, good salaries or what have you, good house and so forth, and all of a sudden those people who were gay rebels in the 1960s become neoconservatives in the 1980s and say, you know, they got the good life, they bought the idea, they think that this is going to go on forever. Have not studied the manipulation through rewards. And they went to college to study psychology. You know, and I've told you before how we are miseducated when we study psychology. We'll go right in there and study Skinnerian psychology and conditioning. And what have I told you before? We will not put ourselves in the place of the rat in the box. And we will not put ourselves in the place of the Pavlovian dog. We misidentify ourselves with the experimenter. But the actual condition of African people at this point is that of the Pavlovian dog and the Skinnerian rat. With others being at the controls and manipulating rewards and punishments, and what we call negative reinforcements as a way of controlling our behavior. And when we talk about behavior in psychology, we not only talk about movement, but mental behavior as well, thinking in certain ways, seeing in certain ways, experiencing the world in certain ways. We include that too under behavior when we talk about behavior. And there are three fundamental ways, you see, of maintaining behavior in a conditioning situation: rewards, and then what we call positive reinforcement. Then you have negative reinforcement, which isn't the same as punishment. It's a situation where you release a person from a painful situation on the condition that they behave in a particular way. So in a sense, you put them in a painful situation. You say, well, I'll let you out of this if you do this. Or if they're in a painful situation, you say, well, I'll remove this situation if you behave in this way. This is what we call negative reinforcement, you see, a release from a negative situation, which is a form of reward. So I will release you from the ghetto if you say, I am an American and I love it. There is no racism. I don't feel dominated. Individualism is the highest ideology in the world. Okay, we'll give you a little extra pennies and you can live in a nice house. Get yourself a VCR and look at movies. And then those who belong to the underclass, we just can't change them. You know, they're in a painful situation. They look like they even like it there. So for those, we have to administer what? Punishment. You see. But what do all of these have in common? Social control. Control. You see, so those of us who are being rewarded by the American system doesn't mean that we are any more out of the control of Europeans than those of us who are in the prisons. The game is the same. Social control, and until you decide as a people to end the capacity of whites to control your lives, we will always be subservient to them. And if one day we have to recognize that it becomes necessary to annihilate African people in order that the European stays in social control, then they will annihilate us. I don't care what kind of degrees you got and what kind of money you're making. Well, and notice when I said earlier about this class I was in, as long as I teach them these Eurocentric concepts in the psychology class, the class is very comfortable. No problems, everybody's hooked in. As soon as I talk about how this applies to blackness, as soon as I move from the rat in the box and how that rat is black people, twisting and turning, total discomfort. When I told my class yesterday, I said, I'm going to do a lecture over here at Hunter tomorrow. What are you going to talk about? Third world economics? You know? And these are black students, you know, making a joke out of it. You know, and that was the implication here, you know. Oh, it's a way of saying, we're uncomfortable when you talk about the third world. We think it's unimportant that you keep raising this issue in the class. You see, we think this is what you're talking about when you relate this to us is unimportant. It makes us unhappy that you bring this issue up. Even though I told them at the end of the class, you are not going to be comfortable in here. You're going to be anxiety-ridden in here. Because if you're in a social science course and you're not upset, you are being lied to. The day you sit in social science courses, give them the state that this world is in, and you're not upset and confronting yourself, you're being lied to. You should be most uncomfortable in these courses because they should force you to look and deal with reality, ladies and gentlemen. And so consequently then, what do we have? People who want to go to courses that make them do what? Feel good. That they're comfortable in. That they enjoy. You see? That they find not boring. You see? And often what they define as boring, courses that force them to think and force them to analyze and force them to slow down in their impulsive kind of thinking. Because you see, a lot of us are perseverators in our thinking, you know. Sometimes I'm talking in class and I mention one word and often some students go with it, you know, all out of the context. Because we are often knee-jerked. We are prepared to respond to words and symbols and just run off with it and forget the whole logic and context of what is being discussed and dealt with, you see. So in this instance, then we have to deal with it. Now, wrap it up here then. The situation then is, we discussed in our class yesterday also conditioning. And it's very interesting because it's so simple. Because it says conditioning, the essence of operant conditioning is that behavior is controlled by its consequences. Very simple statement, but very, very powerful. Mommy. So therefore, and the whole idea is, if a particular behavior brings satisfaction and brings, you know, rewards, it is that behavior is more likely to be repeated and to increase in frequency. If it, of course, is to bring dissatisfaction and pain and so forth, it is less likely to be. A very simple statement, but a lot of people overlook the simplicity of the statement because it's often these very simple concepts which are rooted in the foundations. You see, the real things in the world cannot be complicated, ladies and gentlemen. I often tell people the day that I see a religion using a book to get to its God, it's already alienated. Yeah. Yeah, when you've got to learn how to read in order to know your God, you're already out of business. Note that the founders of your religion didn't have the Bible. They didn't read any Bible. Jesus wasn't reading the Bible. And Peter and all those, these things came 70 years and 100 years later. Why, they even seem as supremely religious, but you now with the book, it seems as less than they are. How can they be supremely related to God without a Bible, without a book, and you with the book of seed is disconnected?
How can God relate to man in a very basic sort of way if he requires that they read first? Come on. The very essence and principles of the relationship of God must be guided to much more simply than reading theology and getting degrees in theology, ladies and gentlemen. What a trick God must have played on us if he requires that we read and get degrees in theology in order to be next to him. That's crazy. It must mean then that the very basic understanding of God and the very basic connection of God must be essentially simple and straightforward. But of course you need experts and authorities to do what? Complicate it so that then you have to come to them to get to Jesus. Let me pray for you and then you'll feel better. I No, the man of God. You mean I'm not of God? How did you come to be the man of God? I'm not the man of God. You see? But this is a part of the whole hierarchy. This is a part of the hell thing, you know, the hierarchical things are going to send you to. Now, what are we talking about here then in terms of the conditioning situation here? The control of consequences. The essence of power then is the ability to control the consequences of other people's actions. Right? That's the essence of it. If I can determine what is going to happen to you as a result of the way you behave, then that is power. And if then your behavior is to a significant degree controlled by the consequences it brings, and if I can control the consequences it brings, then ultimately I control what? I control your behavior. And if I control your behavior over time, that it becomes habitual. And if it becomes habitual, it becomes a part of your character. It becomes a part of your personality. And so in essence, the ability to control the consequences of somebody else's behavior to a good degree ultimately means the ability to create their personality and to create those people as individuals. And when you see that rat in the Skinner box, that rat is being created. It's unlike any other rat. It's not the original rat. When you pick a rat out and put it in that box and control the conditions under which it lives, control when it's going to get fed, when it's going to get watered, when it's going to get food, and all the other kinds of things, that rat will learn various behaviors that reflect those conditions. We not only live under certain conditions, the conditions live in us. And when you look at this situation, as I tell my, and this is what I teach my students, that makes them uncomfortable, you know. And I say, look at your situation. The ghetto is a nigger box. What do we mean there? It is a set of conditions designed to create niggers out of Africans. And of course you will see who controls your water, who controls food, who controls jobs, who controls information, and you will see, and who manipulates all of these things in terms of behavior. And says, well, you have to write this way, you got to write this sentence this way, you got to talk this way, dress this way, walk this way, think this way, all of this if you are to get this job. And then when you get this job, you are to behave this way, so, if you are to get paid. And you can see then a creation of personality and behavior as a result of someone controlling consequences of behavior. So ultimately, you see, if you're going to create yourself, you're going to have to also get what? The ability to control the consequences of your own actions. And it, no matter how well educated you are, if that education does not lead to the end point of getting control of the consequences of our own behavior, it means ultimately then, no matter how well educated we are not going to be able to create ourselves as African people.
How good and how pleasant it would be before God and man.
There was two kinds of slaves. There was the house Negro and the field Negro. The house Negro, they lived in the house with master. They dressed pretty good. They ate good because they ate his food, but he left. They lived in the attic or the basement, but still they lived near their master. And they loved their master more than the master loved himself. They would give their life to save their master's house quicker than the master would. The house Negro, if the master said, we got a good house here, the house Negro said, yeah, we got a good house here. Whenever the master said we, he said we. That's how you can tell a house Negro. if the master's house caught on fire, the house Negro would fight harder to put the blaze out than the master would. If the master got sick, the house Negro would say, "What's the matter, boss? We sick? We sick." He identified himself with his master more than his master identified with himself. And if you came to the house Negro and said, "Let's run away, let's escape, let's separate," that house Negro would look at you and say, "Man, you crazy. What you mean separate? Where is there a better house than this? Where can I wear better clothes than this? Where can I eat better food than this?" That was that house Negro. In those days, he was called a house nigger. And that's what we call him today, because we still got some house niggers running around here. This modern house Negro loves his master. He wants to live near him. He'll pay three times as much as the house is worth just to live near his master. And then brag about, "I'm the only Negro out here." "I'm the only one on my job. I'm the only one in this school. You're nothing but a house Negro." And if someone come to you right now and say, "Let's separate," you say the same thing that the house Negro said on the plantation. "What you mean separate? From America? This good white man? Where you gonna get a better job than you get here? I mean, this is what you say. I ain't left nothing in Africa." That's what you say. Why, you left your mind in Africa.
Many students of human behavior and historians have wondered why enslaved Africans suffered such inhumane treatment for so many centuries and attempted so few revolts. People don't typically revolt when conditions are so oppressive that they have no hope of succeeding. The slavery system in America was a comprehensive and effective system. Our ancestors were not only outnumbered, but had no weapons to speak of or no training on using them. Confined to plantations, they had little knowledge of the physical terrain of the South. Few could read or write. Their skin color made them highly visible targets for white militia that patrolled the roads night and day to quell potential unrest. Most of the North was still allied with the Southern slaveholders, and blacks did not have irate African nations crossing the Atlantic seeking revenge to free their enslaved people. Even though enslaved Africans considered themselves little more than the working dead, they knew that a failed revolt meant certain death. In both direct and indirect ways, many enslaved Africans found ways to resist even under the most treacherous of circumstances. Most enslaved Africans were so overwhelmed by the magnitude of their situation that they preferred to withdraw from reality or psychologically join their white oppressors. At a subtle level of resistance, slaves nonetheless responded to white oppression by feigning illness, crippling themselves, committing suicide, poisoning their masters, setting fire to the properties on which they labored. More aggressive enslaved Africans escaped to Maroon settlement and Indian communities in the wilderness, where they often plotted against their oppressors. Maroons were groups of enslaved Africans who established their own communities. They routinely raided slave plantations for food, supplies, and to liberate other enslaved Africans. While most slave revolts in America were small and ineffective, at least three chilled the hearts of the American South. The three key revolts were led by Gabriel Prosser in 1800, Denmark Vesey in 1822, and Nat Turner in 1831. These revolts set the stage for the ultimate revolt, the Civil War of the 1860s, that ended slavery as an institution by popular belief. So what inspired these rebellions? Toussaint L'Ouverture, a former carriage driver and natural military genius, led the enslaved Africans of Haiti and the Dominican Republic in a rebellion against Napoleon of France at the end of the 1700s. His army suffered a stunning defeat. This was the only time in the development of the Western world that whites blinked and blacks seized their freedom. To stave off a chain of black revolts in the United States, slaveholders tried in vain to keep the news of the Haitian Revolution from the ears of enslaved Africans in America. L'Ouverture's rebellion made an impact. Reportedly, whenever an enslaved African chafed under chains, this man's name was whispered. So why were there so many unsuccessful slave revolts in North America? To understand that, you got to understand one of his major contributors. Meritorious manumission was a legal act of freeing an enslaved African for good deeds as defined by the national public policy. Meritorious manumission could be granted to an enslaved African who distinguished himself by saving the life of a master, inventing a new medicine, or snitching on a fellow enslaved person. This was a destructive weapon in the slaveholder's arsenal and a powerful component of the public policy. The importance that whites placed on black informants is emphatically demonstrated with the Hayward Shepherd John Brown incident. Hayward Shepherd, a black porter from the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad in Harper's Ferry, Virginia, was the first person who was killed by John Brown and his party in their raid the night of October 16, 1859. He recognized the group and tried to ward the town and was killed on sight. There is a 900-pound granite monument there in his honor. That reads, on the night of October 16th, Hayward Shepherd, an industrious, respected colored freeman, was mortally wounded by John Brown's raiders. In pursuance of his duties as an employee, he became a victim of an attempted insurrection. This boulder is erected by the United Daughters of the Confederacy and the Sons of the Confederate Veterans as a memorial to Hayward Shepherd, exemplifying the character and faithfulness of thousands of Negroes who, under many temptations through subsequent years of war, so conducted themselves that no stain was left upon a record which in this peculiar heritage of the American people, a everlasting tribute to the best of both races. So he was rewarded for placing the way of life of the white citizens of Harper's Ferry above the welfare of his own people. Meritorious manumission was not only used as an instrument to reward blacks, but was a device for destroying black unity and race loyalty. It created a very effective informant system. The meritorious manumission policy introduced a strong element of distrust among enslaved Africans and made it more difficult for enslaved Africans to organize a revolt. The psychological techniques used were designed to drive wedges between enslaved Africans and to train them to trust no other than the white slave master. Meritorious manumission was first instituted in Virginia in 1710. According to Peter M. Bergman's The Chronological History of the Negro in America, the technique of meritorious manumission was adopted by all the colonies. The first use in Virginia of the legislative power to break the bonds of an enslaved person was made in the year of 1710. A Negro named Will, cited for discouraging a slave conspiracy in the colony and in recognition and reward of the public service, an act was passed conferring freedom upon him. This act of freedom read, the said Negro Will is and shall forever hereafter be free from slavery and shall enjoy and have all the liberties, privileges, and immunities of or to a free Negro belonging. The act of freedom restores some of the liberties, privileges, and immunities that Maryland's public edict took from blacks in 1638. This national discipline policy was so successful that in more than 250 years of slavery, there was not one successful slave revolt in America. Of the mere 150 to 200 attempts of slave insurrections, in nearly every instance, the slave revolts were prematurely exposed. Unfortunately, the informant in nearly every instance was a black person. Social engineering effectively destroyed most black people's sense of community, trust, and accountability, though undocumented. Many black Americans believe that soon after this inception, meritorious manumission was merged into what we now call Willie Lynchism. According to popular belief, Willie Lynch offered mind-controlling ideology to destroy black people's sense of community as he was a professional slave trainer. He proposed that slave masters create divisions among blacks and separate them along the lines of gender, age, tribe, culture, class, rank, and skin color. To this day, the effects of Willie Lynchism continues to encourage black individualism, selfishness, and self-hatred. Meritorious manumission has a lot of similarities with the communist prisoners of war brainwashing program of the American soldiers. The only difference is that the prisoners of war who survived were hospitalized and deprogrammed. No such therapy has ever been offered to black Americans. Meritorious manumission and Willie Lynchism conditioning broke our will. Only a few thousand or more than 5 million enslaved Africans ever attempted an escape. Out of the 252 known slave revolts, there was a black informant nearly every time. Many fought with the Confederacy to maintain slavery. Some even elected to stay with the white slave masters after the war was over. The analysis of brainwashing provides insight into why blacks avoid blackness and lack accountability to members of our team. What is the success rate of this social engineering? After 360 years, 44 million descendants of enslaved Africans have the shortest life expectancy, low self-esteem, remain divided, and non-competitive. They remain fearful and continue to seek white approval and rewards that come along with being a sellout. Government and dominant white society has historically rewarded blacks who identify with the larger white community and place their welfare above that of the black community. For selling out their own community, blacks were often rewarded with special positions, money, and meritorious manumission. The rewards of meritorious manumission, the law that rewarded enslaved Africans who sold out their brothers and sisters, has created a legacy that is still with us today. Blacks have no balancing social devices that punish those blacks who sacrifice members of the race for their own personal advantage. Black America is void of social accountability policies and enforcement devices. What is a sense of community and why is it important? A sense of community is a collective thinking, seeing and behaving as we and not as me. Aberrant behavior among blacks began in 1710 and were formalized into law when the Virginia colonial government introduced meritorious manumission, a public policy that was used to condition and instill internal controls into the psyche of enslaved Africans. The practice awarded blacks who saw slavery through the eyes of white society, were willing to work against their own group's interests, and inform on members of their own race who are planning to escape and free other blacks. Blacks must first establish cultural standards of acceptable social behavior and jettison behavior patterns that render them economically non-competitive. Blacks must openly acknowledge that certain behavior is detrimental to the race and must be changed. They can no longer excuse destructive behavior by hiding within the frail walls of civil rights issues or charging it to poverty politics or the legacies of slavery. Black institutions, churches, schools, families, and other social organizations must assert themselves regarding the problems facing black America. They must establish and promote codes of conduct to protect their community from black antisocial and dysfunctional behaviors. These foundation institutions should cooperatively use a variety of social tools to persuade members of the black race to comply with certain behavior standards. Social tools, including sanctions, rewards, and punishments, must not only encourage respect and unity for the group, but should also instill trepidation in potential violators. Black institutions must define and teach roles, values, and beliefs, must also house enforcement powers. Neither law enforcement, politicians, nor the military can bring about community togetherness. A strong sense of community springs from group power. Institutions must be constructed within black communities to attract and retain wealth, information, and power. Industrial power is more potent and lasting than individual power. For instance, white wealth and political power is manifested through a wide variety of organizations and institutions. These entities are financed and directed by governments and corporate leaders to protect and enhance the privileged social positions of their race. All black self-empowerment activities must contribute to the building a strong sense of peoplehood and commitment to the acculturation principle of taking care of oneself, one's family, and one's race. A true sense of peoplehood is not the same as the rhetoric of brotherhood and sisterhood. Like whites, blacks will have differences of opinion and interracial differences and disagreements, but black lives are interconnected by virtue of their color. So blacks must be committed to moving towards mutually benefited goals. New black leadership must establish a national vision and articulate an acceptable code of conduct, behavior that is just as injurious to the other black people, and property must be strictly prohibited. Black institutions such as churches, community agencies, and fraternal organizations are needed to reestablish a broad sense of community and peoplehood. Their historical roles and resources must be broadened and linked via a national plan. In his autobiography, the great revolutionary Huey P. Newton effectively used an old African proverb, "I am we." He said, "If you met an African in the ancient times and asked him who he was, he would reply, 'I am we. All of us are one and the multitude, and we need to return to this state of consciousness.'"
But niggas shouldn't be scared of revolution. Because revolution is nothing but change. And all niggas do is change. Niggas come in for murk and change into pimping clothes. They hit the streets to make some quick change. Niggas change their hair from black to red to blonde. And old black hair and lips will change. Niggas kill other niggas just because one didn't receive the correct change. Niggas change from men to women, from women to men. Niggas change, change, change. You hear niggas say, things are changing, things are changing. Yeah, things are changing. Nigga things into black nigga things. Black nigga things that go through all kinds of changes. The change in the day that makes you mad and rave. Black power, and the change that comes over them at night as they sigh and moan. Light side, woo, light side. Niggas always going through bullshit change. But when it comes for real change, niggas are scared of revolution. Niggas are actors. Niggas are actors. Niggas act like they're in a hurry to catch the first act of the great white hope. Niggas try to act like Malcolm. And when a white man doesn't react toward them like he did Malcolm, niggas want to act violently. Niggas act so cool and strict, causing white people to say, "What makes you niggas act like that?" Niggas act like you ain't never seen nobody act before. But when it comes to acting out revolution, niggas say, "I can't dig in action." Niggas are scared of revolution. Niggas are very untogether people. Niggas talk about getting high and riding around in L's. Niggas should get high and ride to hell. Niggas talk about pimping, pimping that, pimping what? Pimping yours, pimping mine. Just to be pimping is a hell of a line. Niggas are very untogether people. Niggas talk about your mind. Talk about my mind stronger than yours. I got that bitch's mind uptight. Niggas don't know a damn thing about the mind, but they'd be right. Niggas are scared of revolution. Niggas fuck. Niggas fuck, fuck, fuck. Niggas love. They've been there so fucking cute. They fuck you around. The first thing they say when they're mad is, fuck it. You play a little too much with them, they say fuck you. When it's time to TCB, niggas are somewhere fucking trying to be nice to them. They fuck over you. Niggas don't realize why they're doing all this fucking. They're getting fucked around. But when they do realize, it's too late. So niggas just get fucked up. Niggas talk about fucking, fucking that, fucking this, fucking yours, fucking my sis, not knowing what they're fucking for. Ain't fucking for love and appreciation. Just fucking to be fucking. Niggas fuck white thighs, black thighs, yellow thighs, brown thighs. Niggas fuck ankles when they want out of thighs. Niggas fuck Charlie, Linda, and Sue. And if you don't mind out, niggas will fuck you. Niggas will fuck fuck if it could be fuck. But when it comes to fucking for revolutionary causes, niggas say fuck revolution. Niggas are scared of revolution. Niggas are players. Niggas are players, are players. Niggas play football, baseball, and basketball while the white man is cutting off their balls. When a niggas play ain't tight enough to play with some black thighs, niggas play with white thighs to see if they still have some play left. And when ain't no white thighs to play with, niggas play with themselves. Niggas tell you they're ready to be liberated, but when you say, let's go take our liberation, niggas reply, I was just playing. Niggas are playing with revolution and losing. Niggas are scared of revolution. Niggas do a lot of shooting. Niggas do a lot of shooting. Niggas shoot off at the mouth. Niggas shoot blue. Niggas shoot traps. Niggas cut around the corners and shoot down the street. Niggas shoot sharp branches at white women. Niggas shoot dope until they armed. Niggas shoot guns and rifles on New Year's Eve. A new year, the chat is coming in. The white police would do more shooting at them. Where are niggas when the revolution needs some shots? Yeah, you know, niggas are somewhere shooting this shit. Niggas are scared of revolution. Niggas are lovers. Niggas are lovers, are lovers. Niggas love to see Clark Gable make love to Marilyn Monroe. Niggas love to see Taj and fuck over Native. Niggas love to hit an old ranger, yeah. High old silver. Niggas love commercials. Niggas love commercials. Oh, how niggas love commercials. You can take niggas out of the country, but you can't take the country out of niggas. Niggas are lovers, are lovers, are lovers. Niggas love to hear Malcolm rap, but they didn't love Malcolm. Niggas love everything but themselves. But I'm a lover too. Yep, I'm a lover too. I love niggas, I love niggas, I love niggas. Because niggas are me, and I should only love that which is me. I love to see niggas go through changes, love to see niggas act, love to see niggas make them plays and shoot the shit. But there's one thing about niggas I do not love. Niggas are scared of revolution.
Not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on Detroit from 29 District. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
The poem is by Taimbe Jess, and the poem is, when niggas love revolution like they love the bull. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, youth will wear red, black, and green patches over the emblems on their starter jackets. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, brothers will gather regularly at barbershops and corner stops to discuss George Jackson and the Handbook of Revolutionary Warfare and People's War before they go home to take care of their children each night. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, playground basketball courts will become paramilitary training grounds where we learn to shoot guns at the enemy and not baskets for bets. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, we will spend hours and hours watching our children grow into soldiers and not basketball players. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, we will know CIA stats, FBI stats, infant mortality stats, police brutality stats, political prisoners and prisoners of war, and literacy training techniques like we know Paxson's shoe size or Shaq's shoe size or the way we know Rodman or Pippen's rebounds or Grant's salary and all the intimate details of Michael's last gambling spree. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, you will be able to ask any youth on the street, who is Sundiata Okoye? Who is Assata Shakur? Who is Sekou Odinga? Who is Ruchel McGee and Jonathan Jackson? You will be able to ask, who is Matula Shakur? Who is Queen Mother Moore? They will be able to tell you without skipping a beat. Niggas love revolution like they love the bull. You will go on to ask them about Michael Jordan, and they will say, who? When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, masses of us will go down to tear up Carolina coroner and his office to find out what really happened to James Jordan instead of waiting on the word of newspapers and sheriff's offices. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, we will show up in Washington, D.C. with the Million Man March, with our God and with our guns. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, they will start to seriously wonder why one Negro putting a brown ball through a white net makes more mint money in one season than they will make in an entire lifetime, and do something about it. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, you will see Phil Jackson running up and down an empty court minutes before game time screaming, where are my niggas? Where are my niggas? Where are my niggas? As the niggas leave the stadium to go build liberation schools in their community. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, all niggas will refuse to shoot ball with the president, with or without their dashikis on. When niggas love revolution like they love the bulls, we'll become associated with the sound of CIA agents, snitches, rats, and agent provocateurs who join our organizations and work against the legitimate Adam's aspirations of our people who yearn to breathe free. Drug dealers and others will make when they are thrown gracefully face first into open manholes. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, Nike will no longer be able to sell $160 basketball shoes in the black community, because we would rather spend the money on liberation and revolution. Thank you. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, they will love it, they will love it more than chitlins, more than all my children, more than Jerry Carroll, more than permanent, more than Cadillacs and Mercedes-Benz and Rolls-Royces and BMW's cars. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, when niggas love their family like they love the bull, when niggas love their children like they love the bull, when niggas love to be free like they love the bull, when niggas love struggle like they love the bull, when niggas love dignity like they love the bulls, when niggas love niggas like they love the bulls, we will become black people and all the bullshit will hit the fans.